is Tuesday, August 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Republicans open their convention to nominate President Trump as he makes a surprise appearance, and again, without proof, warns Democrats could cheat.
The only way they can take this election away from us is if this is a rigged election. We're going to win this election.
Democratic lawmakers grill the U.S. Postmaster General over recent changes that have been delaying mail service.
My last question is this.
Thank you,
what
sir.
What the heck are you doing? What
you,
the
sir.
Heck are you doing?
We will do everything we can to handle and deliver election mail.
Also ahead, protests erupt in the U.S. state of Wisconsin after a black man is shot by police. It's all on today's International Edition. Republicans began their national convention Monday by formally nominating President Trump for another term. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
At their downsized convention in Charlotte, delegates unanimously sent the president to a November showdown with Joe Biden and soon after heard from their nominee, who during a nearly hour-long rambling speech called it the most important election in American history.
Our country can go in a horrible, horrible direction. Or in an even greater direction.
Even as delegates cheered, the president's facing a deeply skeptical public. An APNORC Center for Public Affairs research poll finds 75% of Americans think the country is going in the wrong direction. As he did in 2016, the president's raising questions about the election's integrity, saying the only way he'll lose is if it's rigged. Sagar Magani, Washington.
And as millions of Americans plan to vote mail-in due to the pandemic, Trump used his surprise opening day appearance to again make unsubstantiated claims that Democrats will cheat with mail-in ballots.
What they're doing is using COVID to steal an election.
Right.
They're using COVID to defraud the American people, all of our people, of a fair and free election.
The president and Republicans will use this week to try to make the case that the economic and political future of the country depends on Trump's reelection. Joining us now from Charlotte, North Carolina, where the in-person portion of the convention is being held, VOA's Esha Sarai. Thanks for being with us.
It's unusual that the president, normally he would maybe make a quick appearance at the beginning of a convention, or the nominee, as Joe Biden last week, and then make his big speech at the end of the week. But it sounds like beginning Monday, where we heard from the president, we will be hearing from him every day at some point. And then, of course, Monday night, we did hear from many of his allies and surrogates. Give us a brief overview of who we heard from.
We had some big name Republican representatives and senators, including Tim Scott from South Carolina, Steve Scalise from Louisiana, and Jim Jordan from Ohio. Also on the list was former ambassador to the UN for President Trump, Nikki Haley, who was previously governor of South Carolina, and Donald Trump Jr., President Trump's son, was also on the list.
And what can we expect going forward tonight, Tuesday night, and potentially beyond?
Some of First Lady Melania Trump is expected to speak from the newly renovated Rose Garden. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is also expected to speak while he is traveling in Europe. Other people on the list are President Trump's other son, Eric Trump, his daughter, Tiffany Trump, and Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky.
Do you expect any surprises throughout the week?
It's hard to say. President Trump's appearance in Charlotte at the Convention Center on Monday, while it had been rumored and anticipated, it wasn't formally on his schedule for the day. And the Republican Party, the RNC, has said in previous weeks that there will be a nightly surprise. So unsure whether that will be President Trump himself speaking every night for the rest of the week.
Normally in a conventional convention, we know that this is partially going to be with some people virtually. As you mentioned, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be speaking on video from outside of the country, and others may be doing some virtual. But a lot of this also, unlike the Democrats last week, will be in person. And usually it culminates with a big acceptance speech on Thursday night by the nominee, which in this case is President Trump accepting the nomination. What can we expect from him, given that it almost sort of seemed like it was an acceptance speech ahead of time on Monday after the roll call?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you said, it's been, you know, an unconventional convention. Most of the big events that would happen at a convention really happened in person on Monday in Charlotte. And so all 336 delegates who were present, which is a scaled down number of what we expected, had their roll call, formally nominated President Trump, and he gave a speech. Though technically his formal acceptance speech is scheduled for Thursday. But in his speech Monday, he spoke a lot about having doubts about mail-in votes, saying the only way the Democrats could win is if they rigged the election. And a lot of the same rhetoric around the pandemic and blaming China for the virus and stating that, you know, he thinks the economy is doing fine. I would imagine that it will be a lot of the same rhetoric on Thursday and perhaps a bit of a lead-in to what the rest of his campaign will look like. But then again, this year, the RNC does not actually have a platform saying, you know, they're focusing on the same theme of Make America Great Again. So we could imagine that his speech Thursday will sound quite a bit like the one he gave Monday from Charlotte.
And he seemed to be giving a warning to Republicans that sounded very similar to the Democrats' warning of President Trump. It sounded like he was almost taking a cue from that, warning Republicans of dire consequences if former Vice President Joe Biden is elected president.
Right. There's been a lot of rhetoric about, you know, the far left is coming to take over the country, which, you know, I'm sure a lot of Democrats find a bit ironic, as many Democrats have criticized Joe Biden for being a bit too moderate. But President Trump is pointing a lot to the unrest that's been seen, particularly in Portland, Oregon, and a few other cities, and Black Lives Matter protests, and saying that this kind of, you know, what he calls chaos or riots is what Republicans could expect to see more of if they elect Joe Biden.
VOA correspondent Esha Sarai in Charlotte, North Carolina. On the convention's first day, 24 former Republican U.S. lawmakers endorsed Democrat Joe Biden for president in the latest rebuke of Trump by members of his own party. Postmaster General Louis DeJoy told lawmakers Monday that he's warned allies of President Donald Trump that repeated attacks on mail-in ballots are not helpful, but he denied that recent changes at the Postal Service are linked to the November elections.
The Postal Service is fully capable and committed to delivering the nation's election mail securely and on time.
DeJoy faced tense questions over an uproar in mail delivery delays since he took the helm in mid-June. In questioning, Massachusetts Democratic Congressman Stephen Lynch said the upheaval at one of the nation's oldest and most popular institutions was either the result of, quote, gross incompetence or on purpose.
In my heart, I'm tempted to ask, after 240 years of patriotic service delivering the mail, how can one person screw this up in just a few weeks? Now, I understand you bring private sector expertise. I guess we couldn't find a government worker who could screw it up this fast.
Joining us now for more on the hearing and DeJoy's testimony is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
A lot of what House Democrats tried to do Monday is to secure an assurance from the Postmaster General that he would secure the mail-in ballot vote this November. And in all of the various ways that they tried to do that, he actually never really fully committed and said that he could do it. What he did say was that he would consider it a sacred priority of his duty as Postmaster General to make sure that all of the mail gets there by Election Day. That was the best that he could offer them in this hearing.
What more did they want that they did not get from him?
A lot of the discussion on Monday in this committee hearing was about some of the changes that DeJoy had allegedly made. One of the more interesting parts of the hearing was when he came out and said, I actually didn't do some of those changes that have been reported in the media. This removal of mail processing machines, this removal of blue collection boxes in public places. He came out and he said, that wasn't me. And if anybody is reporting that, or if anybody in the public is saying that, that's a falsehood. So I think that was one of the more surprising elements of the hearing Monday. When the Democrats eventually followed up on this statement, it was hard to unpick exactly who had ordered these changes. What apparently has been happening, because the U.S. Postal Service has been under so much financial strain in the past decade, is that some of these moves have been made throughout the years as cost-saving measures. What it was a little hard to unpick is how much this has been done, whether DeJoy actually increased the number of removals. This is something that Democrats never really actually followed up on in this hearing.
What's confusing, though, is we know it happened. We've seen the photos of the mailboxes being removed and these mail sorting machines being removed. And I know I heard Democrats say, how would this help their finances or the efficiency of the mail getting out by removing a machine that makes everything go faster? How is that helpful? Did they get an answer to that question?
There was a lot of discussion about that issue, but no real clear answers. You know, remember, we're talking about a government oversight committee looking at an executive branch agency. So there's a give and take here where they want to make sure this agency is functioning because it uses taxpayer dollars, because it's supposed to be functioning for the benefit of the American people. They want to make sure that people aren't claiming overtime when it's not needed, when mail routes aren't being run that aren't useful. So there was some give and take on that issue, and a lot of it is in the eye of the beholder. You know, what's the balance? Should we be running more mail processing machines to make sure it gets processed, but at what cost? So that's really what you get in any discussion of funding of an executive branch agency.
But did they drive home the point at all that despite whatever economic problems the agency is having, that we are, of course, in the middle of a pandemic and it would be safer for people to have the ability to not have to stand in line at the polls as well during an election year?
Well, what really came up in this hearing was largely based on an internal U.S. Postal Service document that the Oversight Committee obtained over the weekend. It was dated from about 2 weeks ago and that said that all of these delays are definitely not due to a drop because of the coronavirus pandemic, which some Republicans have alleged is the real underlying reason. That internal USPS document shows that this is a result of the changes, whether they were instituted by DeJoy or not, have been put into place in recent months. And that when you look at these changes, they are going to have an impact on mail-in voting.
VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. During his first term as president, Donald Trump met three times and reportedly exchanged at least 25 personal letters with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. But those interactions could soon end, depending on the outcome of the November presidential election, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Donald Trump may have redefined what is possible with North Korea, but his challenger, Joe Biden, has promised a more traditional approach to U.S. foes.
I'll be a president who will stand with our allies and friends and make it clear to our adversaries the days of cozying up to dictators is over.
Biden says he wouldn't meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un without preconditions. His running mate, Kamala Harris, said she wouldn't exchange love letters with Kim either. Any talks, if they happen at all, would probably be working-level discussions rather than big summits. Instead, Biden says he would work with allies to pressure North Korea. To analyst Bong Young-sik, that policy sounds like a throwback to that of former U.S. President Barack Obama.
It's going to be very similar to Obama administration's North Korea policy, dubbed as a policy of strategic patience, basically just waiting for North Korea to get smoke out of the hole, out of the desperation.
But after conducting years of tests, North Korea now has a credible nuclear weapons program, and many believe the calculation has changed.
Korea has nuclear weapons and ICBMs that can possibly carry nuclear warheads to at least part of U.S. Territory or U.S. bases in East Asia. So now you can be strategically patient in terms of, engaging in actual nuclear deterrence with North Korea, right? All you need to do is prevent North Korean leadership from pushing the button to fire the missiles.
Trump has had some success. Since the summits began, North Korea has refrained from any big missile or nuclear tests. But for months, North Korea has refused to talk. Trump insists the deadlock will be broken as soon as he's reelected. But Trump is likely to be unpredictable, says analyst Soo Kim of the RAND Corporation.
The principles that he sort of follows does not really seem to be pegged to anything in particular. So whatever whims or mood he feels, he's able to just to backtrack or do a complete 180 from where he was.
For the U.S. and North Korea, it's a wide range of possibilities. There could be more summits, maybe a return to fire and fury threats, or just the same old deadlock that's been there for years. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Wisconsin's governor deployed his state's National Guard Monday to the lakeside town of Kenosha after a night of protests and violence that followed the police shooting of a black man over the weekend. Governor Tony Evers also called for a special legislative session to address problems with law enforcement.
We must begin the long but important path towards ensuring our state and our country starts to live up to our promises of equity and justice.
29-year-old Jacob Blake is hospitalized in serious condition. His children were in the vehicle as Blake was shot in the back while leaning into the SUV. The incident has turned Kenosha into the nation's latest flashpoint in a summer of racial unrest as protesters set cars on fire and clashed with officers in riot gear Sunday night, hours after Blake was wounded. Gunfire ended anti-government protests Sunday evening in Tripoli, the seat of Libya's internationally backed government. Authorities blamed infiltrators into their security forces for the chaos, but some protesters said they didn't fear violence because they had nothing left to lose. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul with Salaheddin Almorgini in Tripoli.
When shots were heard in Tripoli's Martyrs Square Sunday evening, a few protesters scattered. Others cheered, arms aloft, shouting, "Libya! Libya!" There haven't been anti-government protests here in years, as the city has been embroiled in political conflicts and actual wars. In the streets of Tripoli, protesters say these troubles, compounded by the coronavirus pandemic and rampant corruption, have left people desperate, angry, and utterly hopeless. ...24-year-old protester Ahmed bin Shaban says the demands of the people on the streets are just basic services. Electricity is often cut 15 to 20 hours a day, he says, spoiling medicine and food. Frequently, the water is also cut, and when he goes to the bank to collect his salary, bankers often tell him, "We don't have any money." Libya has the biggest oil reserves in Africa, and ordinary Libyans regularly sleep in overnight queues at fuel stations, he says. 9 years ago on Sunday, rebel forces backed by NATO took over Tripoli, forcing Muammar Gaddafi, who ruled the country with an iron fist for more than 40 years, to flee. He was later executed by rebels. In Tripoli on Sunday, people shouted chants, echoing the protests that led to the rebellion back then. "The people demand the fall of the regime," these young men shout. And in Misrata, Libya's third largest city, dozens of people gathered outside a government building, stomping on pictures of officials and holding signs with slogans like, "We won't be silent again, you thieves." Last year, crowds gathered weekly and sometimes daily in Tripoli to protest the assault on the city led by Khalifa Haftar and his eastern military. In June, the siege on Tripoli ended and Haftar's forces retreated. The war lasted more than a year, killing thousands and displacing hundreds of thousands. Last week, Libya's two governments agreed to a ceasefire and to renew negotiations. Haftar, who appears to be sidelined by the deal, rejected the ceasefire through a spokesperson on Sunday. This is Mohammed Abdelsalam Dafas, a 23-year-old college graduate with no job. He says as Libya's two main sides have been fighting, the people have been neglected, leaving many people feeling hopeless. The Sunday protests were mostly peaceful, but videos online show incidents of attacks on security forces' vehicles, and one person was injured when gunfire broke up the event. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul, with Salaheddin Almorgini in Tripoli.
A sentencing hearing has begun for the Australian man who carried out mosque attacks in the New Zealand city of Christchurch in March 2019. Brenton Tarrant has admitted killing 51 worshippers and injuring dozens more. In court Monday, the self-confessed white supremacist has come face to face with relatives of some of his victims. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
A year after his deadly rampage, Brenton Tarrant pleaded guilty to the murders of 51 Muslim worshippers, 40 charges of attempted murder and a terrorism offence. The 29-year-old Australian man had earlier denied attacking two mosques during Friday prayers in Christchurch, New Zealand, before reversing his plea. A sentencing hearing began Monday and is expected to last 4 days. Tarrant faces a minimum prison term of 17 years. But Justice Cameron Mander, the High Court judge in charge of the case, has the authority to order him locked away for life with no parole, a sentence that has never been handed down in New Zealand. More than 60 people will deliver victim impact statements to the court. Some have travelled from overseas and undergone a mandatory 2-week COVID-19 quarantine in order to take part. Among the victims was 35-year-old Hussein Al-Umari. His sister Aya says she wants to look his killer in the eye and tell him her spirit has not been crushed.
My plan is to eyeball him. We'll see how that goes. I'm going to tell him what he intended to do has done the complete opposite effect. Okay, you've killed my brother, but God is still there. So I don't know. We'll see how it goes.
Brenton Tarrant's crime sent waves of grief around the world. Many of his victims were migrants and refugees from India, Somalia, Egypt, Syria and Jordan. The youngest to die was a 3-year-old boy. The attacks horrified New Zealand, an isolated country of 5 million. Its people invariably saw their country as a safe place, far from the extremist violence that scarred other parts of the world. That changed in March 2019. The Friday prayer murders in Christchurch prompted the New Zealand government to ban the military-style semi-automatic weapons that were used by the gunmen. He live-streamed part of his rampage, adding to the trauma of his victims' families. This week, they can tell their stories of pain, loss and survival at the High Court in Christchurch. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Germany says it has placed Alexei Navalny under guard in hospital after determining that the longtime critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin was most likely poisoned while campaigning in Siberia. Navalny collapsed on a plane last week after drinking tea that his allies say they believe was laced with poison. He was flown to Germany for treatment on Saturday. Crews from across the U.S., West, military planes, and National Guard troops have been pouring into California to join the fight against 24 major wildfires burning across the state as officials warned of more dry lightning storms approaching. The worst of the blazes, including the second and third largest wildfires in recorded California history, were burning in and around the San Francisco area, where more than 200,000 people have been told to flee their homes. You're listening to International Edition. Back in a minute.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama, home to Space Camp, faced permanent closure as COVID-19 forced the internationally popular Science and Technology Center to turn students and visitors away. But as VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, an online campaign to save Space Camp is providing a lifeline.
2019, the 50th anniversary of astronauts landing on the moon. It's a banner year for the U.S. Space and Rocket Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Visitors from around the world came to celebrate the city where the Saturn V rocket that carried astronauts into space was developed.
We had record number of attendance. We had almost 45,000 students in Space Camp last year in 2019. We were starting off 2020 so strong. Our attendance was higher just even in the museum, and we were heading into a sold-out summer of Space Camp.
Pat Ammons with the U.S. Space and Rocket Center says it came to a halt when COVID-19 arrived in the U.S. Space Camp, the popular program the center operates where youth learn how to be astronauts, closed completely in March. 2 months of revenue from campers and visitors to the museum evaporated instantly. Although a state agency, Ammons says the center doesn't get state or federal funding and didn't qualify for benefits in the multi-trillion-dollar coronavirus relief package passed by Congress earlier this year.
We earn our income through people who walk in the door and the students who attend our Space Camp program,
which includes many international visitors.
About 20% yearly of our students come from overseas. In the fall particularly, we have a lot of students who come from Australia, the UK, China, India, a lot of students who come as part of school groups. And so those students, of course, won't be coming this year.
As attendance tanked, the center was quickly burning through savings.
By the end of October, we would have exhausted all the remaining cash that we had.
If we do not receive a minimum of $1.5 million by the end of October, we were not going to be able to keep the museum open, and we were not going to be able to offer Space Camp in 2021.
Ben Chandler, a Space Camp graduate and now chairman of the nonprofit U.S. Space and Rocket Center Education Foundation, which helps fund the center and Space Camp, says that's when it was decided to ask for help through an online GoFundMe campaign.
Inside of 7 days, we've raised over $1.5 million through, like, last I had looked, there had been 8,000 individuals that had donated to the campaign.
Boeing Corporation and SAIC were two of the biggest donors, together contributing $750,000.
Thank you for saving Space Camp.
Chandler says while the organization is somewhat transitioning from survive to thrive mode, the fundraising effort isn't over.
We're trying to repair some of that financial damage, and that's why we're going to keep the campaign open and alive and to try to do as much good as we can.
Today, while Space Camp is open, operations are significantly reduced.
We would be typically crawling with over 1,000 children a week here. We are operating at about 40 to 50% of our normal capacity in the museum, and we're only at 20% of our students in Space Camp.
Ammons says Space Camp won't stay open year-round this year due to health restrictions.
Our fall and winter season is international students and school groups. And so obviously international students and school groups aren't going to be coming to Space Camp this fall and winter.
But the hope is that progress in reducing the spread of COVID-19 will allow the Space and Rocket Center to welcome more visitors and more space campers when the facility prepares to blast off for a new, more normal season in 2021. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News.
Good, I'm going uptown.
And singer-songwriter Justin Townes Earl, a leading performer of American roots music, known for his introspective and haunting style, has died at the age of 38. Earl was the son of country star Steve Earl. Over the weekend, his family posted an Instagram announcement of his death, telling fans, quote, "So many of you have relied on his music and lyrics over the years, and we hope that his music will continue to guide you on your journey." You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for listening.
Times come and they go.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
And to AU, African Youth, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.